This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, the Iranian president says the Islamic Republic of Iran has become so strong that hegemonic powers cannot coerce it into doing what they want. Tensions simmering in the occupied West Bank. Just hours ago, the Israeli military conducted deadly raids on two Palestinian refugee camps. And in the UK, skyrocketing energy costs could drive NHS officials to adopt belt-tightening measures with a likely impact on patient care. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. The Iranian president says the Islamic Republic of Iran has become so strong that hegemonic powers cannot coerce it into doing what they want.
Today, they know that they can no longer bully Iran. They know that the Islamic Republic of Iran has become powerful. They know that Iran is invincible.
Ebrahim Raisi said Iran has suffered numerous injustices over the years and has now become so strong that the whole world is well aware of its high status around the globe. He said Iran has not only become a regional heavyweight but secured a good standing on the world stage. He said Iran has always been seeking justice for all. Elsewhere in his remarks, the president noted that Washington has admitted its maximum pressure policy against Tehran has failed. He then lambasted the global hegemony for violating human rights and keeping countries in ignorance. He made the comments at the 7th General Assembly of the Ahlul Bayt World Assembly in Tehran. Israeli forces have killed two Palestinian men in the occupied West Bank amid rising tensions. One of the victims, Yazan Afana, was shot dead during Israel's storming of a neighborhood in the city of Al-Bira. The second victim, Samer Khalid, was killed by the Israeli fire during confrontations, which erupted during a regime's raid on the Balata refugee camp east of the city of Nablus. In recent months, the Israeli regime military has stepped up deadly raids in the occupied West Bank, launching fierce assaults on the local population. The raids usually leads to clashes with Palestinians protesting the Israeli violations. A Palestinian prisoner on hunger strike for almost 6 months has decided to end his strike after Israeli officials agreed to release him. This came after Israel agreed to set a ceiling for Khalil Awada's administrative detention and release him on October the 2nd. Until then, he will remain at hospital to recover. Awada has been on an open-ended hunger strike for 172 days in protest at his detention without charge or trial. Doctors had already warned that he could die at any moment. The Palestinian inmate had been arrested 5 times since 2005 for political activism and was placed under the so-called administrative detention 3 times ever since. Over 680 Palestinians are being held by Israel without charge or trial. Thousands of Lebanese have attended a mass rally to commemorate the anniversary of what they consider the kidnapping of prominent Shia cleric Sayyid Musa al-Sadr. Lebanese parliament speaker and the head of the Amal movement spoke on the occasion, stressing that the case is a national issue.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese parliament speaker Nabih Biri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
Iran's foreign minister says Tehran seeks stronger guarantees from the U.S. to have a sustainable agreement to revive the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks during a joint press conference with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Moscow. During the talks, the two sides discussed increasing bilateral cooperation regardless of the dictates of the West. Our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortunova, has a report for us.
Regular communications and meetings between Moscow and Tehran officials are necessary to continue work along the lines outlined by both the Iranian and Russian presidents. This was also pointed out at the recent meeting between the foreign ministers of Iran and Russia in Moscow.
It is necessary to concentrate together with our friends, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the creation of reliable constructive mechanisms that allow, regardless of any diktat, to develop mutually beneficial cooperation.
Iranian foreign minister and his Russian counterpart held talks on Wednesday where they also discussed the issue of Ukraine. Amir Abdullahian said proposals were put forward regarding assisting with peace and the cessation of hostilities in Ukraine. However, the Iranian official did not provide other details on the matter. The head of the Iranian foreign ministry also announced Iran's readiness to help resolve the situation around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
It is necessary to use all existing opportunities to resolve this conflict. Therefore, Iran is ready to provide any assistance to establish calm and peace at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, as well as the surrounding area.
The two sides are targeting deepening trade ties in several fields, including satellites, grain, and a joint move away from the dollar. Nearly all joint projects are aimed at nullifying Washington's sanctions efforts, rendering them fruitless. Despite the sanctions, trade turnover between the two countries is growing at a record pace. Such an alliance between Iran and Russia is perceived especially sharply in the West.
Our countries, in fact, hysterically, in the past they were great empires. The USSR was under powerful pressure, as is Russia at the moment, as is Iran. Such states like Iran and Russia have their own independent national policy, and today's stage of cooperation between them looks very positive and in the required quality.
After the high-level meeting between the two diplomats, work on a comprehensive document of cooperation between Russia and Iran is at its final stage.
Both ministers pointed out that Russia and Iran are focused on creating such mechanisms that will allow the states to continue cooperation regardless of the actions of Western countries now, when the international situation requires regular synchronization of clocks and coordinations of their actions. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan is once again embroiled in controversy as he appears before Islamabad High Court over charges of contempt of court. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
Undeterred by legal and political challenges, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan arrives at Islamabad High Court. He was summoned over his derogatory remarks uttered during a speech in the capital, Islamabad, on August 20. Khan had threatened to file court cases against senior police officials after his close aide, Shehbaz Gill, was arrested on August 9. Khan accused police forces of torturing Gill while he was in custody. In the same speech, he also singled out a female judge, saying the judiciary is biased towards his party and that it should brace itself for the consequences. Khan has submitted a written reply to the court, saying he will not apologize for his remarks, but is ready to withdraw the words if they were inappropriate. Islamabad High Court has described Khan's response as unsatisfactory and directed him to submit a fresh statement. Khan can be disqualified for 5 years from taking part in politics if he is found guilty of contempt of court. His supporters believe Khan has done nothing wrong.
Imran Khan has done nothing wrong, and he fully believes in independence of judiciary. He respects judiciary, whereas PMLN people, they attack judiciary every day. They should be held accountable.
Pakistan's law minister, however, is convinced that Khan indeed committed a contempt of court.
We believe that Imran Khan's case must be treated under Article 25 of the Constitution and in line with how courts in the past have dealt with the contempt cases against other politicians.
Khan was ousted from power in April through a vote of no confidence, but he termed his ouster as a US-backed conspiracy. His popularity, however, has increased in recent months. Many observers believe that any move to seek his disqualification may backfire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
UK hospitals have warned that patient care may have to be cut to offset huge increases in energy bills over the winter months. Most hospital groups say they expect bills to at least double as the price hikes have already kicked in. They say the gap in funding from rising inflation will either have to be made up by fewer staff being employed, longer waiting times for care, or other areas of patient care being cut back. They say failure to properly compensate the NHS for inflation will only increase pressure on the health service. UK inflation is at a 40-year high, with the dire predictions that rates could climb further. That makes households and non-domestic customers alike vulnerable to the surge in prices. Elsewhere, Kiev has accused Moscow of attacking a city housing Europe's largest nuclear plant ahead of a visit by UN inspectors. Ukraine says Russian troops shelled the city in Energodar, where the Zaporizhia nuclear facility is located. Officials published photos of damaged buildings there with smoke spiraling above them. They demanded Russia stop what they called provocative acts and give inspectors of the UN nuclear agency access to the atomic facility. This comes ahead of a planned visit to the plant by a team of inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi says the agency aims to prevent a nuclear accident and preserve the facility. Both Russia and Ukraine have repeatedly traded blame over attacks in the area. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's legal team has slammed the U.S. government for its pursuit of classified documents at his home. Trump's lawyers dismissed as unjustified and legally dubious the FBI's raid on August the 8th, in which the documents were seized. His attorney said the purported justification for The initiation of the government's probe was the alleged discovery of sensitive information. In the presidential records, they said the discovery was to be fully anticipated, given the very nature of presidential records. The reaction came in response to a bombshell filing in which the U.S. Department of Justice said top-secret documents were likely concealed at Trump's estate. To obstruct an FBI investigation, the government also rejected a call by Trump's legal team for an independent review of the material seized. Well, the U.S. has invaded several countries over the past decades. A major new study has concluded that U.S. military interventions increasingly target the Middle East and Africa, making up more than a quarter of such campaigns throughout its history. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria are some of the recent examples where American interventions caused chaos, bloodshed, and instability.
The death toll from the latest clashes between rival armed groups in the Libyan capital Tripoli passed 30, with over 150 people also injured. The fighting raised fears of a major nationwide conflict between a UN-recognized and parliament-backed government. Libya's unraveling has become a symbol of the limits of U.S. power and the folly of military intervention in distant countries. The U.S. is to blame for Libya's current turmoil. After an American-led intervention in 2011 to stop Muammar Gaddafi's atrocities, created a security vacuum in the country. Since then, the security vacuum has been filled by legions of armed militias, foreign mercenaries, extremists, human traffickers, and regional and international powers who have all transformed the North African country into an exporter of instability and mayhem. The footprints of Washington's intervention in war are in several other countries as well. U.S. interventions in past decades have failed to bring democracy to countries around the world. Countries like Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan have been some of the victims of U.S. interventions, still experiencing chaos. A major new study has concluded that U.S. military interventions increasingly target the Middle East and Africa, making up more than a quarter of the country's campaigns throughout its history. The United States is spending an exorbitant amount of money on arms while making trouble in the world with its hundreds of foreign military bases. The U.S. military had about 750 bases overseas across 80 countries and territories in 2021. Earlier this year, the Biden administration expanded the U.S. military footprint in Africa by reversing a decision by former U.S. President Donald Trump to pull troops out of Somalia, thereby establishing a permanent military base in the country.
The United States has intervened in Somalia, Libya, Iraq. We would like to intervene in Iran, Syria, and that's only in the last few years. And I think that the fundamental problem is this. We are seeking military solutions to political problems.
In 2001, the U.S. has spent an estimated $8 trillion on wars. Washington has around 800 military bases worldwide, and it drops an average of about 50 bombs a day in different countries around the world. And the fact that it has conducted three major wars in the last decade without any success shows the flawed approach it has towards different countries under the banner of spreading democracy. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
The limelight.
Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. We now present you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled, Sino-forming of Global South Passes Point of No Return. China's exports to the largest economies of the global south have nearly doubled from pre-COVID levels to a seasonally adjusted $70 billion in June 2022, from $38 billion in June 2019. Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. As Western nations question the benefits of globalization, China has become the world's leading globalizer. What I call China's plan to Sinoform the world in a 2020 book has advanced so far that it is beyond the capacity of the United States and its allies to impede. 500 million people in neighboring countries now depend on Chinese technology for their communications, data processing, and logistics, providing China with a nearly limitless resource of young workers for its industries and an ever-expanding export market. For China, economic outreach to the global south is key to breaking through American efforts to contain China's drive for economic predominance. The influential Observer columnist Chen Feng on 28th of July wrote, "China has to solve the problem of generating its own independent growth momentum after breaking through the critical point of the Matthew effect. The economic maxim that rich countries get richer and poor countries get poorer." Chen Feng said, "America's comprehensive and unlimited anti-China campaign can slow down China's development at the cost of a greater deceleration of the United States." But China is not only putting in place a dual cycle that is promoting domestic consumption as well as exports, adding China also divides the external export cycle into two sub-cycles, Europe and the United States on the one hand, and the Belt and Road, Asia, Africa and Latin America on the other. What we observe in the trade data suggests that China's investments are paying off in most of the developing world. Western policymakers have been looking in the wrong direction. China's trade with the global south plus South Korea and Taiwan is now as large as its combined exports to the United States and Europe. This is by far the most important event in the world economy since the rise of China itself. The populations of the developing world are dwindling at a faster rate in high-income Asia than elsewhere. The scarcest resource in the world is young workers who have enough education to enter the world economy. When Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese revolutionary leader, began his reforms in 1979, China's per capita gross domestic product was less than $200, and just 3% of adults had tertiary education. China's message to the countries of the global south is, "You can grow like we did. If you let us build your infrastructure, install your digital economy, construct your factories, hire your workers and sell you our products." In Vietnam, Indonesia, Mexico, Turkey, Brazil and a dozen other developing countries, political leaders have taken China's offer. The Carnegie Endowment wrote in an 11th of July report on China's success in Indonesia. Many claim that China exports its developmental model and imposes it on other countries. But Chinese players extend their influence by working through local actors and local institutions while adapting and assimilating local and traditional forms, norms and practices. In the case of Indonesia, for example, the Carnegie Report says, "On average, Indonesians distrust China and many Chinese firms. Yet, top telecom infrastructure provider Huawei and, to a lesser extent, China's second-largest telecommunications equipment maker, ZTE, have successfully positioned themselves as trusted cybersecurity providers to the Indonesian government and the Indonesian nation. This has been no easy feat, given long-held Indonesian animosity towards China. Many Chinese companies have faced protests over concerns they were taking local jobs. Huawei and ZTE have suffered no such fate, nor has there been a broad coalition of Indonesian voices against using Chinese technology in critical telecommunications infrastructure. In short, Indonesians care a lot more about Chinese cement plants than they do about Huawei involvement in fifth-generation networks. Carnegie reports Huawei is training 10,000 Indonesian officials in cybersecurity. China, in effect, is delivering a turnkey digital economy to Indonesia, with everything included from broadband base stations to training. On 25th of July, Indonesian President Joko Widodo visited Beijing, the first head of state to visit the country since last February's Winter Olympics. The Chinese website Observer commented, "On 22nd of July, high-level officials from China and Indonesia held a video conference and agreed on advanced plans for the joint construction of the Belt and Road Initiative and the Global Maritime Fulcrum, and make all-out effort to ensure that the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed rail is completed and open to traffic as scheduled, and continuously deepen cooperation in the regional comprehensive economic corridor." The 145-kilometre rail link between Jakarta and Bandung is a prestige project, but it symbolises China's rising profile in Southeast Asia's largest country. China's burgeoning role in the Indonesian economy does not fit the profile of what American critics call debt-trap diplomacy. On the contrary, higher raw materials prices allow Indonesia to pay cash for Chinese imports. The country has run a current account surplus for the past 2 years. Chinese exports to Mexico now comprise 16% of the country's total and have grown as fast as China's exports to Southeast Asia. Telecommunications is a big contributor. Mexico in 2020 had 77 broadband accounts per 100 people versus just 23 in 2012. In between, Huawei built a mobile broadband network and the cost of service dropped by about three quarters. As a banker for a Hong Kong boutique, I brought Huawei officials to Mexico and Mexico's ambassador to Huawei headquarters in Shenzhen, China. Huawei explained to the Mexicans that they had a big economy but woefully inadequate broadband. The Huawei officials said, "They let us build you a broadband network and the ecosystem of e-commerce, e-finance and digital technologies that go with it, and you can become rich like China." In fact, Huawei had a published plan for the digital transformation of every country in the world. Many of them are in the advanced stage of implementation. China's investments in Mexico have risen rapidly in the past 2 years. $5.8 billion of China's total $20 billion commitment to the country was disbursed in the past 2 years, in part because Chinese companies are moving facilities out of the United States to its southern neighbor, Mexico. China's investment in Brazil, now the world's largest producer of soybeans, are considerably larger. Luis Augusto de Castro Neves and Tulio Cariello, in a 2022 book, report, "As of 2020, Brazil has received more than half of all Chinese investment in Latin America, around $66 billion, with three-fourths of that investment dedicated to the energy sector, and the rest going to agriculture, infrastructure, and other industries. Turkey's imports from China have tripled since 2018. China also is the country's largest export market. The first train to Istanbul from the Chinese city of Xi'an arrived in 2019 on a line built under the Belt and Road Initiative. China's largest transport company, COSCO Shipping, bought a $1 billion controlling stake in Turkey's third-largest container port. China financed Istanbul's new airport with a $6.2 billion loan. Turkey's swap line with China allows it to pay for imports in yuan rather than in US dollars. As the Turkish lira crashed last year and Turkey's dollar reserves fell, the local currency swap line became a critical source of trade financing for Turkey. China's trade with the Global South could shift to national currency in short order. By 2019, China had established $500 billion in local currency swap lines with other countries. According to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, swap lines among Asian central banks are estimated at $470 billion. Financial technology is now available to conduct retail transactions directly between Asian countries. According to the Monetary Authority of Singapore and the Bank of Thailand, in 2021, Singapore and Thailand linked their real-time payment systems, PayNow and PromptPay, enabling customers of participating banks in Singapore and Thailand to transfer funds of up to $1,000 to or 25,000 baht daily across the two countries using just a mobile number. The Sino-forming of the world has far-reaching strategic implications. China's influence in Southeast Asia is growing almost as fast as its trade profile. Indonesia has embraced China's vision of economic development driven by digital infrastructure and managed by Chinese technology providers. The Philippines elected Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos by an unprecedented two-thirds majority, partly on a platform of greater economic cooperation with China. Turkey is now an economic dependency of China, which has sustained its imports despite the collapse of the Turkish lira and rampant inflation in the country.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A strategic failure, that is how a top U.S. general has described the Afghan war, pointing to the Taliban back in power and the U.S. withdrawal from that country. Meanwhile, the Taliban has marked its first-year anniversary of foreign and American troops exiting, with flags and chants in central Kabul, while residents rejoice that peace has come despite the deteriorating economic situation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the U.S.'s longest war and why its intervention was a failure, as stated by their own general. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Brian Terrell joins us. He's a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Molloy, Iowa. Also joining us, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Brian Terrell. When you have a U.S. general, and it's a sobering assessment, say, quote, outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure, the enemy is in charge in Kabul, there's no way else to describe that, that the outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days. The fact that he's saying that, that it is a failure, what does that say about this war altogether?
Well, I would question whether it was a failure or not. The failure is... That presupposes that winning the war was ever something that was contemplated or even desired. As Julian Assange said back in 2011, I think, that the purpose of this war was to wash money out of the U.S. and European tax bases through Afghanistan into the hands of the transnational security elite. And as that, it's been very successful. These, you know, billions and billions of dollars have disappeared, but they have not disappeared into thin air. They've gone into some people's pockets. And it's been it's done that quite successfully. And it does not bode well because we're continuing to foment more of these wars. And the money keeps rolling in for Raytheon and Boeing and such.
Who's making off with this money? How does that transpire? Can you give us a short version of how that happens?
Well, Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, is formerly member of the Board of Directors for Raytheon Technologies. This was a great deal from the beginning for Dick Cheney and his investments during that time. I had the opportunity to visit Afghanistan. I was there seven times from 2009 to 2018. And each visit, I saw the situation deteriorate. My last visits, I would be the only Westerner leaving the airport after deplaning and going through immigration because everybody else was going from getting on a helicopter and going to another armed compound. It was getting more and more dangerous and devolving. During that time, the United States, not the war expenses, but on the so-called reconstruction, spent more money. More money was spent reconstruction of Afghanistan than the entire Marshall Plan at the end of World War II that rebuilt the cities of Western Europe. And saw nothing of that. The only roads that were paved were between the military bases, and the only housing, you know, was the hospitals were getting worse. I'd visit the hospitals; they were getting, you know, the schools. Everything was getting worse the whole time, every time. And the compounds where the elite lived, the oligarchs lived, they were improved, and the
sure. Sure. Let's see what Daniel Lazar thinks about this. Daniel Lazar, you heard our guest there. Lots of money not going for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, billions of dollars. That puts another light on this whole situation. Not that it wasn't known before. Who do you think made out with all this money?
Well, it wasn't billions. It was trillions. It was an astonishing sum. And yes, it went to the arms manufacturers, the contractors, various NGOs. And countless other parasites who wound up making small fortunes off this entire misadventure. But I would emphasize that it wasn't merely a get-rich scheme. The America completely lost its way. Its imperial doctrine utterly failed after 9/11. And one reason is that America was unable to admit that the country that was most responsible for that attack was Saudi Arabia. Because if America had admitted that, it would have had to essentially break relations with Riyadh and completely reconstruct or rethink its entire military presence in the Persian Gulf region. So rather than do that, America chose to blame everybody else that it possibly could instead of Riyadh. I mean, it blamed Iran, it blamed Afghanistan, it blamed Saddam Hussein, it blamed everyone. And the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq were just fantastic misadventures. I mean, just America really went crazy and really behaved in a way that was utterly irrational, even by imperialist standards. And empires often behave quite irrationally. And so the U.S. really blundered into a quagmire. It had no way of winning and never really had thought of even tried to define what meaning might even make, might even mean. And so as a result, it ran through trillions, left the country in worse shape than when it arrived, brought nothing but poverty and suffering, and now has left Afghanistan to its own devices while seizing something like $7 billion in Afghan overseas deposits. So it's just a colossal scandal, no matter how you look at it.
Indeed. One of the things there, Brian Terrell, that our guest Daniel Lazar mentioned is the fact that they didn't know what they were doing. I'd like to expand a little bit more on that with you, because the reports that have indicated and have confirmed the fact that senior U.S. officials actually failed to tell the truth when it came to what was happening there and about the performance throughout this 20-year occupation that happened there. They actually made rosy announcements about what was going on there. They were hiding the facts and the evidence that this war had become unwinnable. But they were presenting another side to that story, a false side, that they were successful. This lying that they did was happening for a long time. Why is it then that nothing was done about the prevention of the lies, but more so for them to find a solution to improve what was going on there? Because the occupation continued, even though reports came out that they had lied about it.
Well, there's a long history of this in the Vietnam War. Of course, we have the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg released, telling that the rosy story that General Westmoreland and the presidents Nixon and Johnson were portraying were lies. Way back then, and there have been leakers, the WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. People have had the courage to speak up. And what was happening to them is the punishment of the ones who told the truth. Another general who should be mentioned is General Stanley McChrystal, who was under Obama was the head of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and he made the mistake of having a telling the truth interview with Rolling Stone magazine, and he said back then that this was unwinnable and that he was. What he said, for every innocent Afghan who's killed, the United States is creating 10 new enemies. And of course, President Obama got his job. He was demoted. He was fired for telling the truth. So the truth has been out there. The U.S. media has been very complicit in trying to silence that truth. This is not something, it's having these generals today come out as like, who knew we were losing? Who knew that this was a waste? It really is disingenuous. I think this was something that we knew from the beginning. And in the beginning too,
let me come to you, Daniel Lazar. I think we may have lost. I'm sorry, we lost connection with you, Brian Terrell, for a second. This is what's very confusing, Daniel Lazar, and I'd like to find out from you if you have an answer. Back in 2015, Douglas Lute is a 3-star Army general who served in the position of what's called the White House's Afghan War Czar during the Bush and Obama administration. This is what he has said. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, And this is the part that's really shocking. We didn't know what we were doing. He says, what are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking. I'm trying to really digest that. How do you go into another country and then not know what you're doing there?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. It's very hard to understand. But remember, first of all, that after 9/11, America had to invade someone, and its primary target was Saddam Hussein in Iraq. However, the Democrats thought that was ridiculous because Al Qaeda had a certain presence in Afghanistan, and in fact. Its chief, Osama bin Laden, was actually physically located in Afghanistan. So to oblige the Democrats to satisfy their concerns, the Bush administration invaded Afghanistan. But it really invaded Afghanistan merely to show that it could invade Afghanistan using a very small force and using various allies on the ground to overthrow the regime. And that operation was highly successful, But the next day arrived, and America had no idea what to do. It hadn't given any thought as to what it would do with this immense country of 40 million people once it succeeded in toppling the Taliban. So therefore, they spent 20 years dithering, in utter confusion. Knowing nothing about the country itself, knowing nothing about what the goal should be, what America was doing there, anything like that. So that's what we saw. And I might add, by the way, that one of the great champions of the Afghan invasion was Joe Biden, who at the time was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a major figure in U.S. foreign policy formulation. And what was Joe Biden's punishment? Obviously, there was no punishment. He was rewarded by being, transported into the White House, where he then was able to preside over this utter defeat that America suffered last August. It's really bonkers.
So many things here that just boggles the mind, Brian Terrell. One of them is something that actually the U.S. wants to boast that it does when it intervenes illegally in some sense into other nations, but many U.S. officials have acknowledged that Afghanistan's that the U.S. purpose there was to remake it into a modern nation, okay? So that to me gives the notion of nation building in a sense. Now this is what Obama stated after the U.S.-backed NATO invasion of Libya about his worst mistake. He said probably failing to plan for the day after, okay? What I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya. Did the U.S. think this through in terms of militarily coming in, but then what it is going to do to, in this case, rebuild the nation or to move towards nation building?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that presupposes that's actually what they wanted to do. And I think whatever the motives that someone like Obama or Biden might personally have had, the idea that if you repeat a mistake over and over and over again, repeat it in Vietnam, repeat it in Libya, repeat it in Afghanistan, repeat it, Honduras, repeat it in, the list could go on and on. It's a sign of a criminal pattern. It's not good, well-intentioned people making mistakes over and over and over again. The same mistakes happened, and again with from the beginning of this, from President Carter starting to arm the Mujahideen, there were always people, there were always experts, there were always people saying, "Don't do it, don't do it." As we're seeing in Europe now, from 1993, there were people, anybody knowing anything about the situation in Europe saying NATO cannot expand. We're not going to expand NATO. Even Joe Biden warned in 1993, warned that expanding NATO was going to provoke Russia. And look where we are. It's not a progression of the same mistakes over and over and over again is a pattern of criminality. If these people are, if these are truly mistakes, and perhaps they are, then we're being ruled by and have been ruled for decades by a government that is absolutely incapable, inept, unable to govern itself, much less trying to export itself, the idea that the United States today is trying to rebuild other nations while our own infrastructure is falling apart, while our own education and our roads and everything that makes for a decent life. The life expectancy of Americans is going down for the first time while we're spending more than $1 trillion on extending the life of our nuclear weapons, which are clearly illegal under all these international laws that we're party to. There may be good intentions there, but the good intentions are not. It shows how little good intentions count.
Well, I mean, to wrap our thoughts around this is so difficult, Daniel Lazar. The U.S. government is cited by a Washington Post report that came out a few years back, in which it interviewed 400 or 500 military personnel. One of the things that it came out with was said that it deliberately misled the public, that it was common, it said, to distort statistics to make it appear that the U.S. was actually winning the war. So you're lying to the American people, you're lying to the world, really, after you spend all this money. But the way of going about lying is what I'm questioning here. When you come and you distort numbers and you mislead the public in that way, that's incredible, right? And then it's still happening because after Afghanistan, there are other wars now. I mean, we're looking at somewhat Ukraine or somewhat for the U.S. to be involved in the Ukraine conflict. What is your impression of the U.S. going about it that way?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct. It really is mind-boggling. But you've got to remember, let's go back to 9/11. The U.S. had invested literally trillions of dollars in militarizing the Persian Gulf and strengthening the Saudi regime. And what it got for its efforts on September 11th, 2001, was death and destruction on an unprecedented scale in Lower Manhattan. So American policies had blown up in its face. Now, in any kind of honest government, that would have meant a massive reanalysis, reconceptualization, rethink of where U.S. Middle East policy was going. But that was the last thing Washington wanted to do or was even capable of doing. So as a result, America engaged in these completely eccentric, willfully absurd actions whose purpose was to, number one, lie to the American people about the, what had happened on 9/11. Number two, to sort of demonstrate that, to flex its military muscle to show it was still a tough guy. And number three, to knock over some unfriendly regimes in the Middle East, beginning with the Taliban in Afghanistan and then culminating with with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And by the way, if the war in Iraq had been successful, the U.S. then had a list of something like five other countries it was planning to invade, including Iran. Now, this was complete madness. It was nothing more than a gigantic temper tantrum, and it led to disaster. And it just goes to show how completely broken the American political leadership really is, and political leadership in both parties. I mean, the American government operates in a bubble. It has little understanding of the world at large, little understanding of how to conduct itself relative to the world at large, and is just careening out of control, creating disaster wherever it goes. I mean, Afghanistan was a start, but it's not the end by any means.
Well, I was trying to figure out, Brian Terrell, how much money the U.S. is spending on its involvement with the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm going to go out on a limb and ask this question if you think that my thinking here is either correct or completely out of line in a sense. You have this 20-year occupation war that ended and the fiasco that it was, and even the way it ended was a fiasco. And now that that's ended, we are seeing, about 6 months into the Ukraine conflict, we're seeing how the U.S. Is spending money, a few hundred million dollars a day is one estimate, but if you take a look at the bigger picture, it's billions of dollars. Are we looking at a pattern where there needs to be a war for the U.S. government to flow cash into it? And based on the past, like Afghanistan, there are people who are making out that are profiting from this, hence that war, the term war profiteering, which is coined from the U.S., basically, is showing itself again. Is this a pattern that we're seeing here?
Well, yes, it is. The United States, at this point, we really don't have any other product. We don't have anything to offer. Everything that we have you go in a department store in the United States and everything is made in China, or our clothing comes from Guatemala. The export that we have is weapons, and it's the mainstay of our economy. We don't have anything else to offer the world right now that anybody wants. I think we're also dealing with climate change and a frantic effort to maintain the control over fossil fuels instead of looking for alternatives. The biggest part of the budget for the Department of Energy for the United States is developing nuclear weapons. It's not looking for. Renewable alternatives to fossil fuel. It's not looking for independence. It's looking for control of other people's oil.
Okay.
While we build more weapons.
Final question goes to you, Daniel Lazar. The question about the CIA having terrorists on its payroll, where it's again, this is not new news. You had the Daesh and you had these terrorists. And warlords, as they called it, on CIA's payroll because they needed their cooperation. Are we looking at that still continuing today in Afghanistan, in a sense? Because the U.S. says it's pulled out, but it still is involved one way or another. 30 seconds.
Yes, I have no hard information, but I suspect the same thing. I suspect the U.S. still has a hand in Afghanistan. Still has a finger in the pie. I assume that Saudi money is flowing to ISIS. And okay. If that is truly the case, I assume that the CIA knows about it.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Brian Terrell, thank you so much, political commentator and peace activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikava Tahwe and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.